Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of You Have Tread on Me. Tonight is Time for a Plan. That'll be our Tuesday show from now on, Time for a Plan, where we will actually be talking about the only constitutionally lawful plan to restore the U.S. back to a lawful constitutional republic with true representatives again. You know, we hear all this talk about the Second Amendment gives us the right to restore our government, but that's not quite true. The lawful means to restore our Constitution was through a Continental Congress and then a Constitutional Convention, and then and only then, if the federal government refused to acknowledge the people and the Committees of Safety, then and only then was the Second Amendment applicable. We see this throughout history, and we also find this in the writings of our founding fathers as well. So tonight's show, Gary and I will be talking about committees of safety. And if we have time, we're going to get into a little bit of an extra bit at the end that Gary was approached about a couple months ago and asked a question which led him into some interesting ideas and some interesting trains of thought, if you will. So, with that being said, though, let's delve into the committees of safety here on You Have Tried Me Radio. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Well, hello, Randy. How are you this evening?
I'm doing good. Doing good.
Hey, you forgot one thing. You were talking about the only constitutional remedy, the only peaceful constitutional remedy. That qualifier has to be there because the Declaration and the Constitution do not preclude the necessity of taking up arms, if necessary, to restore the government. So the only peaceful solution, the remedy, is to do everything that we possibly can to achieve forcing the government back into compliance with the Constitution. And that's what we had covered the last three programs with that petition, the new olive branch petition, you might call it. The committees of safety are peaceful, at least as long as they're peaceful. They become a means of the community working together from the bottom up instead of the top down. I don't know if you've noticed, if you follow the Tea Parties, they're coming up with their platforms already, and they're supporting Republican candidates, and, well, what you've got is a fringe, or maybe a renaming of the Republican Party. The committees of safety, though, their platform would be built upon what the people in the committees pushed up the various tiers, from the local ones to the county to the state and to a national committee of safety. So the whole idea behind a committee is it's the civil authority that's been recognized since the Magna Carta as absolute necessity for certain functions within government. Two of those functions are militia and juries. The military arm has to be obedient to a civil authority, and the judicial, the courts cannot self-appoint, as is happening so often around the country. Back in the 90s, there were citizens' grand juries being called, and basically they were comprised of people that felt like being a jurist on the grand jury. It doesn't work that way. If it did, just say you live in Podunk County and you've got different factions throughout the county, and each of them creates their own grand jury based upon the people that, the sympathies of the people in the say, three or four different areas of the county. So you have three or four different grand juries, each self-appointed. And then they indict people from the other grand juries because they think that they're wrong and they think they're wrong. There's no authority to a self-appointed jury. How can there possibly be? If you had a small community of 20 people and you got 10 on each grand jury and they started indicting the other side, there's nothing resolved from that. The only way and the reason for civil authority, quite simply, is that you take the three or four districts or the 20 people, they form a committee of safety, and then the committee of safety you turn out by lot or by name or however they want to, but they appoint the grand jury. Now everybody's in agreement, so we have civil authority creating a grand jury or a petite jury to try a case. It cannot work any other way. Likewise, the militia. Oh, a while back we talked, Alabama and Florida both had submitted statutes that talked about unlawful paramilitary organizations. Well, a paramilitary organization is unlawful unless it's sanctioned by the government. And I'll give you two examples that are sanctioned by the government. I'll give you three. The FBI, Blackwater, and the local police department. They're paramilitary organizations. They're sanctioned by government. Not that they're constitutional, and I've been reading a rather interesting article lately, and I'll be doing an article based upon it. It's something I believed all along. The police departments are illegal. The FBI is illegal.
The FBI is illegal. The federal government was supposed to have no policing powers.
U.S. Marshals only, and U.S. Marshals serve warrants for the U.S. courts.
Yes,
that's it.
That was it.
Actually, they're bailiffs. They call them marshals, but they're bailiffs. And they're not a police force. But the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation. How can you investigate when you're shooting? Look what happened in Waco. The FBI was the murderers in this case. They weren't investigating. They destroyed the crime scene before the assigned investigators, the Texas Rangers, even got there. They took a whole day wasting the site, destroying it. So their militia is lawful. If it's subordinate to a civil authority. If it's not subordinate to a civil authority, it's little different than the police, Blackwater, and the FBI. So if a militia is created, if it has gone to the county and the county won't recognize it, it's not subordinate to a civil authority because the civil authority, the county, the existing county, has not said, we'll be the civil authority that oversees you. You can go to the governor of the state. Now, the states all create militia members by virtue of your age and your ability. There are exemptions that can't serve on the militia. So you are militia as an individual, but as an organized group of militia, which you have every right to for your own protection and defense, you can come together as militia. If you're not under a civil authority, you might get by with it. You might not. They could deem you. I don't think that the government wants to try and challenge it, but they have every right to come in and deem you an unlawful paramilitary under state law because you have not met the traditional historical requirements of subordination to civil authority. However, if there's a committee of safety, and that committee of safety is the civil authority that you seek to be subordinate to, then that civil authority will commission all officers. If funds are available, will provide equipment, pay, anything else that might be necessary. But the commissioned officers then are agents of the Committee of Safety, and they're bound by the direction they received from the Committee of Safety. And I'll give you a good example of how this works. There was a fellow named was George Washington. He was a member of a convention, a Continental Congress, in 1775. He was a delegate from Virginia. When he was appointed Commander-in-Chief of the military forces, which really didn't exist at the time, he gave up his position as a delegate. You cannot be a member of the Committee of Safety and be in the militia. So he lost, Virginia lost a delegate the moment they appointed George Washington as Commander-in-Chief. But Washington, throughout the war, and if you've read history, you know absolutely that he recognized his subordination to civil authority, whether it had to do with destroying Boston or not, firing New York or not. So many times he asked Congress, can I do this? And if Congress said no, he did not do it. Now, there was a degree of independence that he had to have. But when it came to things where there was a serious concern, for example, burning New York, he asked for permission. Seizing Boston militarily with the cannons that they'd set up, he'd ask permission. In both cases, the answer was no. You cannot destroy New York. You cannot destroy Boston. So as powerful and as influential as he would never defy the authority of the civil authority that on his level was comprised of the Continental Congress. Now, we've got a lot of talk about courts as well. And as I explained earlier, how can a court possibly self-appoint itself? The Constitution directs the Congress as the civil authority to create the courts, and it gives the president the authority to appoint the judges in the courts. That's subordination to civil authority. That same pattern exists throughout English history. Back in England years ago, a number of people could appoint courts, but they were all civil authorities. The king had his court, the local lords had their courts, the churches had their courts, and that's where the whole concept of habeas corpus came in. Which jurisdiction am I subject to? But each one of them was subordinate to a civil authority, and was assigned or appointed by them. There were cases throughout history where judges were elected. In this country, there are still some places that elect at least local judges. On the higher levels, they're always appointed. But the election is done under the authority of the civil authority, so the same picture holds true, that the necessity for subordination to civil authority. In the case of the judge, it's not subordination like it is in the militia, because the judge has to have what they call judicial independence. Not legislative independence, but judicial independence. And that's a whole other story. But it's important to understand the necessity of having that relationship with the civil authority. Now, if the governor or the county authorized the militia, then the militia is subordinate to them, as was true in colonial times. However, when the royal government ceased to function properly as a government, and the Committee of Safety said, or the militia said, well, we don't want to be subordinate to the royal governor. You know, we're at odds with those people. At that point, they've transferred their allegiance. Now, if you've read my article, The End of the Revolution and Beginning of Independence, is taking the period of a year before Lexington and Concord and looking at what happened in western Massachusetts. There were some cases where the militia that existed in the town would be completely disbanded. They would open up an enlistment for the militia. And if some guy that was known to be a Tory came up and said, I want to be in the militia, they told him no. Some of the officers that had previously been commissioned by the town meeting came in and wanted to be officers. They were told no. So you can disband the militia and recreate it under the authority, but other places simply transferred that authority. Now, there were courts. The beginning of independence talks about one case. There were more in the research I'd done. But when the courts were disbanded, there was a current concern, and it was Woburn, Massachusetts, was concerned about how are we going to deal with criminal charges, crimes brought up since we've disbanded the royal courts in Massachusetts, made the judges resign. So they created a court, assigned the judges and the officers of the court, but the court only heard criminal matters, no civil matters, during the entire period of the Revolution. Civil matters, lawsuits, breach of contract, foreclosures, anything like that, were just put aside. there was no reason to try and deal with that with the other problems that were going on in the colonies. So that lays the groundwork for it. Randy, speak a little.
Sure, no problem. Well, Delta just asked a question in the chat room. Actually, here, let me open my screen up a little bit wider so I can actually see all the question. Delta Yankee was asking, if the COS are in place and they are the civil authority, what makes the existing powers, such as the governor, local law, federal agencies, recognize these committees and allow them to function? What would keep them from just forcefully shutting them down like they do everything else? Well that answer turns... Oh, go ahead, Gary.
First, how could they forcibly shut them down? You can't meet? Wait, look at the First Amendment. It's a peaceful assembly. They can't shut down the Committee of Safety. If it was a Communist Party meeting, perhaps they could. But when you have something that's got 800 years of tradition in our heritage and our culture, you can't just say you can't do that anymore. The whole idea of what we have, in fact, most states adopted the common law as it existed July 4th, 1776. The whole body of law, now they recognized in the courts that we're not going to accept all the law, but the whole body, the whole history of our country, much of the concept behind the Constitution was an evolution of that English heritage. To me, it's inconceivable that they could tell a group of people acting to benefit their community that they would have to disband. Now, in this day and age, nothing's inconceivable, I grant you that. At that point, I would think that the militia would have to defend the Committee of Safety.
I would agree with
you. Now, you understand, state law recognizes the existence of militias, and every state has got in their statutes provision, and the U.S. Code has a provision making people militia. Now, what good is militia if they can't form as a body? Now, if the county won't form them as a body, I think the best way to put it is just say, look, we're worried about Indians attacking us, and so we want to be able to defend ourselves, and we don't believe the police can do it. So we're going out and training even so that we can repel Indian attacks. Well, there's no Indians around here. Well, that's true, but they might come.
And I think it all comes – I think what it all comes down to, though, is the fact that government can shut down anything they want. It's whether we let them shut it down or not. Once we begin exerting our social power, the will of the people – it's like everything else. If they shut it down by force, well, then we know what's going on. If they start shutting down all the militias by force, we know what's going on, and we can begin to act accordingly. But again, like everything else in life, if we do nothing, and we keep playing the same games that we've always played, doing the same things that we've always done, instead of taking a chapter from history that actually worked in the only time in history, a revolution that actually restored, that actually gave birth to a country and it remained free and didn't end up in revolutions afterwards. This is the only time it worked in the history of the world. And it was because of the Committees of Safety. So, you know, we're pretty much down to two choices. We can either keep doing the same old things that have not worked for 100 years, or we can go back to what did work and what is part of our history and our culture. And whether we let them die this time is pretty much up to us. You know, they've been dead for over 100 years.
Yeah, Delta, the royal governor did have a problem with these militias. Seriously. Yeah, in fact, they sent the governor of Massachusetts, military governor of Massachusetts, finally on April 18th, 1775, said, I'm going to do something about these militia. I'm not going to fight them. I'm going to go steal their cannons out in Concord. Yeah, well, that's right. They tried. Now, let's talk about what our rights are. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Next, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, when I was traveling around the country back in the 90s, one of the questions I was asked frequently when I was talking about Waco or just in casual meetings is, we're losing our rights, aren't we? I said, only if you're willing to give them up. Whoever said that the government was going to protect your rights? The Constitution said they're supposed to. But the Founding Fathers found that the English Constitution didn't protect their rights, so they had to do what was necessary. I have the right to keep and bear arms. I recognize that right. So in 1989, I got a concealed weapons permit in Florida. It was good for 1 year. I had fingerprints and all that stuff. But I wanted to prove that I was qualified. I have not, since then, renewed that. I still carry a concealed weapon. I have proof that I'm competent to carry it. So I carry it. Your rights are there. But if somebody comes to take your rights away, what are you going to do? Hand them over? Everything we're talking about, the reason for this program, the reason for You Have Tread on Me, the reason for all of this, and this especially since Waco, is we are concerned that the government will try and take our rights away. They have not taken them away. They keep passing laws, and if you do abide by the laws, then you might be relinquishing some of your rights. That's your choice to do or to not do. But the more organized we get, and you heard Schaefer Cox on here a while back, the more organized we get, the less likely the government is to try and impose those limitations of our rights upon us. If I remember correctly, the state police went to see some guy, and the militia went down there and made sure that everything went smoothly, that there was no bullying, no threatening, no arrest made, or anything else. So, collectively, it's a lot easier to secure your rights. Now, back 250 years ago, especially on the frontier, on the fringes of the civilized areas, Indian attacks were common. During the French and Indian Wars, they were extremely common. Beginning of the Revolution, they became common again, but never in our history, the Europeans on American soil, was there any guaranteed security from attack by Indians? So committees or town meetings or some form of civil authority appointed enlisted militia, appointed officers for their own defense. You cannot let them deny that right to you. Now, if the governor recognizes the militia and is willing to be the civil authority that militia subordinates to, then you've got an obligation to subordinate to that governor. Until you find out that his goals are not consistent with your Constitution, at that point, you have a war. Now, if we think that we're going to get government back without a war, it is quite possible. And we're going to be talking about more of that. We talked about the Olive Branch Petition the last three episodes of the show. If we get enough people to sign that and give it to government and say, these are our grievances and you better do something, and they don't do anything, at least the people that have signed that petition will realize that there is probably no hope. If they said, well, we'll do some of them, hey, that would be a start and we'd have to rethink. But there's a lot in there. If they only did one or two out of 36 of them, or 46, whatever it is, I'm serious concern whether we're going to keep losing our freedoms. So there's a point that it tips. And it becomes violent. But we're looking at a nonviolent method right now. That's what we're talking about. And as we proceed with this discussion, it will go to a mildly violent. But it will continue on. You heard, was it Joe or Martino?
Joe Martino.
Yeah, Joe Martino talking about having a plan. Well, I've been working on a plan for about a year now based on a question that was asked me, and if we get into, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to read something right now. This is CYA. We can still think in this country. So I'm going to read this, this. A question was raised a few months ago in a conversation. The question was, could a revolution be conducted in the modern world considering modern technology, extensive government troops, and battlefield weapons? At first thought, the task seemed so ominous, so daunting, and against such odds that it would be impractical, if not impossible. Upon reflecting on what must have been equally daunting to the founding fathers, it is not, as first anticipated, such an ominous task. The founding fathers faced British forces, the best trained and most successful military in the then world. Its navies were masters of the sea. Its land forces had recently defeated the French and had forced colonization around the world. It controlled the local government and had enacted laws that gave it nearly arbitrary control over the colonies. Sound familiar? The colonies had two things working for them. They had a lack of experience, except those who had recently fought alongside the British in the French Indian Wars. Some had to defend themselves against hostile Indians and thus learn certain tactics used by the Indians. They had local knowledge of the topography, and they had the fortitude and persistence that had helped their forefathers and themselves overcome the obstacles of taming a land which had been little changed from its natural state. Against them were numbers of highly trained soldiers, unlimited supplies and resources, although many of them were located across the ocean that had to be transported, and a multitude of locations, bases within and around the colonies. Mastery of the waterways, and many of the leaders had experience both with fighting Indians and working alongside the colonists. In those first eventful days of April and May and June of 1775, the colonists learned what their weaknesses were and what some of their strengths were. They learned that they were not trained, nor were they inclined to fight face-to-face on the battlefield. They learned that the tactics of the Indian, ambushed by surprise, the hit-run tactics, would damage both the morale and the manpower of the British. They learned that living to fight another day was more important than victory in a battle. One of the major drawbacks in their efforts was that of selecting officers who were astute enough to challenge the ways of traditional warfare. But they did, and with their persistence and their faith in God, prevail. Not by might, rather by tactics and fortitude. Just how could they fight today? We know that they learned that politics should have less to do with officer selection than the competence of the man who would be chosen to lead them into harm's way. Surely they would adapt their tactics to the battlefield and would realize the political necessity of securing faith and assistance from the non-combatants. There are many other generalities that can be addressed, but of greater importance will be the actual circumstances of today's world and the necessity to develop new tactics in order to overcome obstacles that present themselves as the battle begins. This is a theoretical answer to that question. Now, the disclaimer's done. We're not going to go there yet. I think Randy has some more he wants to talk about committees and militia. But that's the introduction to the next step when we're ready to move on. It will be a theoretical answer to the question that was asked months ago. So, Randy, where are we?
We were basically starting to talk about how we can begin forming committees. How are they formed? How are they established? What do we do with them when we get them?
Hey, I assisted in starting committees. I started one with the help of some people. I guess I was the lead in that. And in South Bend, Indiana, Dave Leeper was the lead. But the one in Orlando, Florida, and on the links page, you'll see a flyer we had. Have you given your consent is what we call the flyer. Since government is based on the consent of the people, the question of have you given your consent became very significant. Well, we handed out flyers, got some radio stations to announce a meeting. We unfortunately didn't book enough time at the Orlando Public Library. Our time was up before the meeting was over. 200 or 300 people attended. There was a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of questions. This is back in 90, 93 or 94, we ended up forming a committee of safety. Now, one thing that was easy in Orlando, since I was traveling around the country and I was just back there for a month or two, I didn't want to be chairman of the committee of safety, so it fell on having an election and electing chairman for the committee of safety. That ended up happening on the sidewalk because we had overstayed our time in the meeting room at the library. It was an auditorium type meeting room. In South Bend, Indiana, the same dilemma was there. And now this is where, earlier when I said top-down, like the Tea Parties and the Republicans and the Democrats and what we've learned to accept as government, I think I've mentioned before the inverted triangle. The president should be at the bottom, the people at the top, and instead we've got the president at the top and the people at the bottom. Well, that inverted triangle is very important. So when we started the Committee of Safety in South Bend, Indiana, the people that were helping us get together thought that David Leiber should be the chairman, the first chairman of the Committee of Safety. We had already decided in both cases, in Orlando, the chairman was going to sit for 6 months only, and South Bend, I think it was a year that we'd set up. But who's going to be the first chairman? Are we going to work from the top down, or are we going to work from the bottom up? So it was explained at the first meeting in South Bend that get to know each other, decide who you'd like to be your leader. We want two or three names at least, and then we'll have an election, and we'll find out who's going to be the first chairman of the Committee of Safety and get this thing together. So, and it was hard to convince them. Everybody's looking for Dave. Aren't you going to be the chairman, Dave? And Dave pointed out, no, I mean, this is our Committee of Safety. It's not my Committee of Safety, and we have to decide who the leadership will be. Well, as it was, a couple other names were submitted, but Dave got probably about 70 or 75% of the vote. But the ethics behind that was very important and very significant. And you have to understand, the committee does not belong to the chairman. It doesn't belong to the Democratic or the Republican or the Tea Party. It belongs to the people. And only they can select their leader. You can't come in like the committeeofsafety.org and say, hey, I'm the leader, here's our platform, follow me. That's not it. This has to be absolute grassroots. Whoever gathers for the first Committee of Safety will determine who the first chairman is. It's a committee that grows and has the term, which we believed should be short, so that we don't get conditioned leaders like Ted Kennedy and Byrd and people like that. As the committee grows and gets more diverse group of people and they learn more about the other people in the committee, they begin to understand who is listening and asking questions and seems to have a grasp on what's happening. There's an article referenced in the Linux on Committee of Safety, some thoughts on leadership. And that's just it. It's not the guy that stands up and says, follow me, as most should do now. They might be good officers. From the Committee of Safety, the approach, if the people will follow the officer, that's fine. If the committee will commission him because he will be supporting the committee. But when it comes to the committee itself, who's to say follow me? The ideas, what we pursue, has to come from the majority of the people within the committee. So the guy that stands up and says, follow me, I'm the leader, is the least likely leader. In fact, I don't know if he should even be in the meeting because he doesn't seem to grasp the concept that's so important about the whole concept of Committee of Safety. And that concept is we, collectively, will determine what's best for us, staying within the constraints that we recognize both from the Constitution and the fundamental morality of this country. But the foundation has to be that important. But how do you start a committee? Well, if you're in a large city, as Orlando, you get to write a little promo, and Randy and I'll be glad to help anybody that wants to do these. You have a model of a flyer. It was 5x8, printed on both sides. That way we went down to Kinko's printed both sides, came back, cut them in half. Actually, we had Kinko's cut them in half. And so every, what, 8 cents or whatever we paid for these, we cut them in half, so it was 4 cents a piece for the flyer. You know, the initial money was coming out of our own pockets to get these things going. Went to local radio stations that we knew had some sympathy for, you know, there's something wrong with the government. This is after Waco, so it was easier to find them than, oh, I think it'd be easy to find them right now. But the local radio stations would announce public service announcements free, the meeting and the location and the time. One television station promoted it, and then they came to the meeting. The meeting was held with the instructions no cameras allowed inside because the meeting didn't belong to the people outside. It belonged to the people that were inside and willing to put their time in the committee. Channel 2, WASH, those snuck a camera in. It ended up helping us because I guess they expected dirty, nasty things to happen, and they couldn't even find any bad sound bites out of the whole hour and a half of program, and so they ended up airing something that ended up being pretty good for us. The so you got television stations and radio stations, and they all give free public service announcements, and there's nothing unpublic about committees of safety. It's actually the epitome of public because it's for all the public, at least all the public that's interested. It's not for people that want to see dogs humanely treated or something like that. So it's not even a selective purpose organization. It's an overall organization for the good of the people in the community. You have to find a place for a meeting. Places I suggest, and it might be a good suggestion, too, that, for members of the Committees of Safety. Now, Committee of Safety can't be in the militia, as George Washington explained. Doesn't mean that somebody in the Committee of Safety could not provide instruction for militia. So Vietnam vets would be ideal people for Committees of Safety. And the VFW or American Legion posts might be ideal locations for a gratis meeting hall or a small fee meeting hall. We used the Orlando Public Library, and later on with the Committee of Safety meetings, they were held in the Castleberry Library, a much smaller one with a meeting room, and 30, 40, 50 people could fit comfortably within them. So the most important thing in starting a committee of safety is motivation. Get off your butt and do something. Look at the flyers. Ask Randy and I to help you write a promo. We'll do everything we can. And as you develop one, what we want to do is, now, I don't know if what we did in Orlando was the easiest way. It worked back 15 years ago. South Bend, same thing, where we had radio stations and television stations willing to promote it as well. Worked out fairly well, but we're dealing with a whole new group of people now than we did back then. So what, as you develop your committees, let us know what's happening so that we can begin to write an instruction booklet to help people build committees. If you find something that doesn't work, let us know. If you find something that seems to work quite well, let us know so that we can help others get committees started. Now, once you've got a committee started, there's probably no militia around. There might be. It depends. I mean, we've got militias now looking at starting committees of safety. But if in your community that you don't know of any militia, the fact that you're a committee of safety and there is there in itself. There are a lot of things you can do. They're listed on the committee of safety page. You can support candidates, but don't affiliate with the Tea Party or the Republicans or the Democrats or Libertarians or anybody else. Support the individual, not the party. You don't want to associate with other organizations where there seems to be a tie between you and them because you're public. You're not a private organization. You're a public organization. And as such, you should be somewhat autonomous. Doesn't mean you can't support a cause. This graph being that one that's almost futile in its efforts, but stay in the Fed. If you wanted to help them promote what they're doing. It doesn't mean that they can't. You can't have people from in the Fed come and speak to your committee and pass out literature, or you make it available through the Committee of Safety. But I would avoid putting Committee of Safety on their literature, and I would avoid putting their name on any Committee of Safety literature. Keep a distance. Your decisions have to be not subject to influence by other factions or interests. Once you've got a committee, at committee.org, if you email there, you can have web pages, you can have access to your pages. Back in the 90s, there were four or five committees that had pages up there. When you go to, is there a committee of safety near me, first you see all the states. You hit that state. If there are any committees, and it'll take you, or the county, or whatever the committee's called, and it'll take you there. So if you've got a committee in Smithville, Idaho, and there's no militia around, but you want people to know around Smithville that you're there, other people in Idaho, and perhaps a militia that you weren't even aware of, if you list your committee on that page, and they go there and say, hey, militia, there's a committee right there in Smithville down the road from us. We could go talk with them. Other committees in Idaho, if you haven't touched bases with them, would know that, hey, the people in Smithville have a committee of two. Also, let's get in touch with them. So committee's good for protecting against Indians. It's better as they link together and become in communication with each other and assist each other in growing. And the whole idea behind the committee is it has to grow. On April 12, 1775, just 1 week before Lexington and Concord, John Hancock, who was chairman of the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts, which was not authorized by the royal government, by the way, issued a proclamation asking all the cities, towns, plantations, any community to create a committee of safety. That's how important, even before Lexington and Concord, in Massachusetts, how important it was for the people to start getting together and being able to communicate what's happening, what we should do, and everything else, even before the war. Now, we're at that point that we need to get this foundation called Committees of Safety existed all across the country, maybe even Alaska and Hawaii. We need that foundation. We need it in place. We need communication. We need consideration. We need trust. We need to build a foundation of committees of safety around the country. Once we have that foundation of committees of safety, and if the committees can come to terms with the petition, they would be an ideal support for the petition, the New Olive Branch petition, the You Have Tread on Me petition, or the Under One Banner petition. If we had 300 committees and they had an average of 20 people in them, we'd have 6,000 petitions. If we had 3,000 committees, we'd have 60,000 petitions. If the committees were larger than 20, we'd have even more. It's that collective effort that's been so successful for the NRA. The reason they have a lot of influence is numbers. And the more people we have in the committees of safety, the more influence we have politically, supporting candidates, supporting issues, putting demands on the government. Let's just say we had 3 million committee members, 1% of this country. And that's more than 1% of the adult population in committees of safety. How effective would that be in telling some congressman, don't do that. Do not pass health care. Especially if they understand where committees fit in historically in asking the government to abide by the Constitution, and then the government refused. And so those people that stood by the government, the Tories, left town, moved to England, moved to Canada. So that foundation becomes absolutely imperative if we intend to turn the course of government. Absent a good foundation of committees of safety, it's almost impossible to conceive of an effective change in the direction of government. Come May, by the time the people that are voted in November get in office and start playing in port about May of next year, I think a lot of Tea Party people are going to be sorely disappointed in the performance of the people they supported. It doesn't mean that the people they support had good didn't have good intentions when they went to Washington, but the way Washington has been corrupted, if they expect to get anything done, they will end up finding out they have to trade votes.
Mm-hmm.
What was referred to last year as the second Louisiana purchase was when Louisiana got a promise of a grant of $225 million going to Louisiana if they would vote for health care. That's the type of thing that controls government. If a politician wants to accomplish anything and he won't support the status quo bills, he's going to be told, you ain't going to get nothing done. You might as well go back home and just sit there because you can sit here and you're not going to get a damn thing. And when he realizes that, he's got three choices. He can either go along with them or not go along with them or go public. I doubt that he'll go public. It won't serve him much good. They'll all denounce him, and they'll probably charge him with an ethics violation, and he may end up in prison. That's happened a few times to people that have challenged the lawfulness of the IRS. So they're not going to be effective. No matter where their heart is when they get elected, they will not be effective. You might find four or five party guys who will persist in pursuing issues. They're not going to get anywhere. That's a controlled government up there. They've got so many layers of control in, selection of candidates, funding of campaigns, their own ethics committee. They've got all the tools on their side to keep anything that we want to see accomplished from being accomplished. And until government fears God and the people of this country, they're not going to change their way.
Hey, Gary.
We got
a caller on the phone real quick. Let me bring him on real quick.
Okay.
Let me click. 713, is you, Layton?
Yeah. Hello, Randy. Gary, I have a question for you.
Shoot.
Okay, am I correct, each state, each county level selects two delegates on the Committee of Safety to go to state, and then selects two delegates to go to national?
I think I would recommend something along that line. I think when you go to the national level, it would probably be better for three. When we look at the Continental Congress, there were at least three delegates for every state. Now, every state only had one vote. But a good reason for three is you got a tiebreaker there. If you got two guys, you negate the state. There's nothing prescribed, though. But the local committees would make the county. You look at the jurisdictional lines that exist in the country. Some counties might only have one committee of safety county-wide. You might have a sprawling county. West County, Southwest County, and East County. You might have another county that has dozens of little cities, and they each have one. But I would recommend at least two delegates at that level to go up to the next level. But then you create the county level. When you have, say, this is my feeling. I mean, you know, there's nothing written. You know, this is the theory. But just from a practical standpoint, if you have a county city. And you have three county-level committees within a state, that's probably enough to constitute a state committee of safety. But that doesn't mean you want to stop getting other counties in. Like I said, the broad base is necessary. But I would say two or three delegates each level up.
Okay. I got another question, if you don't mind answering it, is what was the reason y'all's Committee of Safety per se, disbanded? Lack of interest or what?
Well, a couple things happened. One, the guy that was elected chairman on the sidewalk was a state citizen. He understood the state citizenship issue. Now, our application or our subscription form to the committee said, do you recognize that there are two classes of citizen? Excuse me. But he wanted to exclude anybody that hadn't taken the steps to get rid of their U.S. citizenship. Now, I was not a player. I was not even an officer. I just went to the Committee of Safety meetings. I had the only influence I had was my voice. And so I wrote a letter explaining it. And it kind of weakened the committee because he pissed off about 85% of the people that were in the committee when he said, if you haven't declared for state citizenship and revoked your U.S. citizenship, you cannot be in this committee. Now, he's the chairman. They elected him. But he tried to change the nature of it. And I pointed out in the letter that I wrote to him that other people appreciated that 230 years ago, Tories were not allowed, but anybody who was an Englishman was allowed in otherwise. Unless they were inimical to the cause of American liberty, they were allowed in the committees of safety. So how can we nowadays say if somebody hasn't taken a certain step, we're not going to let them in the committee? At that point, he's promoting his program. Now, he's in prison now. He was one of the Tampa common law court people that went to prison for 15 years. But he was also trying to buy trucks with notes that he issued that he never intended to pay. And so that kind of weakened the committee. Now, I left Orlando, and it was still functioning to the best of my knowledge, and we went up to South Bend, and we set the committee up there. And then while I was in South Bend, I got an invitation to go down. When I was in Orlando, the Oklahoma City bombing occurred. When I got up to South Bend, I got invited down to Oklahoma City. I went to Elohim City and investigated the murder of Mike Hill. So I was traveling around. But what happened after the Oklahoma City bombing? And now these committees were formed about that time. Was basically a flight from the all the militias disbanded just about or went underground. The Oklahoma City bombing just kind of destroyed the momentum that had built up from Waco. So it was probably the Oklahoma City bombing more than anything caused people to be concerned about being associated with both militia and committees of safety.
Another demonization of the militia. One other question. You said the chairman wanted to be controlled. I have a misconception. I thought the chairman of the Committee of Safety was only, he had no authority basically other than to make sure the Constitution, laws of the Constitution was according to the Constitution and that the delegates were the ones that voted. Am I correct?
Well, yes. And, you know, as I explained to that meeting in Orlando, we ran out of our hour and a half that we'd set up for the meeting, and then we ended up having an election on the sidewalk in front of the library. What I said before that, though, and I wrote the short article on a thought on leadership as a consequence of what happened there. He was outspoken and said, hey, I'd be glad to run this thing. And sir, okay, you're going to take responsibility. Go ahead. So they voted for him. They didn't get to know him. So when we pick our leaders, yes, we have to pick people that listen, they think, they ask questions, and they don't try and dominate. Now, the whole problem with the Orlando Committee is this guy tried to dominate. That's top down. That's not what it's supposed to be. Actually, the chairman's primary job, chairman's always got influence in any setting because, you know, he calls on PA. There's subtle influence that's always inherent in whoever's sitting at the head of the table.
Yeah, but I was getting at his primary job was to just to make sure everything was constitutional. Am I correct?
Well, as much as well organized and fair.
Right.
I mean, there's, the Constitution doesn't address private meetings, but he's organized and making sure it's a fair forum that everybody gets their say. And there's, you know, if people start arguing, you've got to stop it. It's just to keep the meeting organized. That's his purpose. And then he becomes the functionary. If you decide that you're going to send a letter to somebody, then somebody's got to sign the letter. You don't want to have 36
right.
people sign it, so he'll sign. But it's a functional position, and a good leader will do just that. He'll let the ideas come out. He'll ask questions. He'll say, some good chairman will never say a word, but others will express interesting ideas and thoughts, and when they're done, this, you know, you have the vote, and then here's the decision of the group. Orlando didn't function that way. This guy took over, very domineering, and
do you mind if I had
that weakened it, and then by the time the repercussions of Oklahoma City came out, I guess they just disbanded.
Basically the same thing we have now with our government. My way or no way.
It was pretty much the way he was doing, you know. I don't know, maybe somewhere along the line he'll pull out that letter and it explains what he was doing and what was wrong with it. It was two pages that I wrote to the committee as an outsider because I was not a member of the committee. I had every intention of leaving Orlando. I wrote an article about that time, what if I'm arrested, and after I got done with my court date, within a couple of weeks, I was out of Florida. You know, I wasn't planning on staying there. I wanted to start a committee. I just wish, and this is what I mean about we need to get feedback, what works and what doesn't, because what I learned out of Orlando is you got to be a lot more careful. You might want to have two or three meetings before you elect your first chairman. Just have somebody as an interim chairman. But
yeah,
if you get something like that, he can destroy the committee.
If you don't mind, I'd like to get Randy and try to set up another little talk with you. I got some ideas, but I appreciate you taking the time to answer my question, Aaron. You have a good day.
Not a problem. Hey, we can definitely get that set up. Also, if you don't mind, let me jump in here for a second. You were talking about that top-down and exertion of, you know, wanting to exert their authority or power or control and creating a top-down organization. I want to comment on that for a moment. There's another group out there that have been trying to start the committees of safety. And if you go to www.committeesofsafety.org, I believe is the site, you'll find another committee of safety site there. I got very curious. You know, I know Dr. Edwin Vieira and his stances, but I got really curious one day and I watched and I was really reading through their information. And basically the way they've set up their committee of safety is from the top down. You have a national leader, Dr. Edwin Vieira, who dictates down to everybody, including the states, and then the states dictate down to the counties. That's centralization of power. That's like what our federal government has become now. The committees were never set up like that. That is never how they were done. They were set up on a township and a village basis. Those groups would all gather on the county basis. The counties would then send delegates to the state basis. And then the state would tell the nationals what to, you know, the national, the Continental Congress or the Constitutional Convention, what to do. All the power was local, though. It was never a national organization like that. So be careful. You know, when you're looking at, you know, other people might be out there talking about committees of safety, and just because they say the same name doesn't mean they have the same ideas or the same, or even the same body in mind. You know, what that group has done is they've taken the committees of safety and turned them into another federal government-type organization.
And not a voice of the people by the people.
Exactly. It's from Dr. Edwin Vieira down, and we know what rolls downhill.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning him.
So, you know, be careful out there. Whenever you go on your research in committees of safety, you know, go back and read the, you know, read what's on committee.org. Compare what else is out there. Now, Gary has referenced this information and documented it very heavily, so compare that. You know, compare the references. And if what you're reading out there from another group doesn't jive, well, then you know there's a problem. You know, if they're talking about a national organization with a national leadership and one guy sitting at the top, well, that's not how the committee's worked.
There is no one guy. There's a chairman, but a committee is what runs it.
Well, exactly. So,
Bill, we were talking about delegates, and, you know, many occurrences of what I'm going to tell you. In fact, they were so strong that even for the Declaration of Independence, some of the delegates sent back to their colony to ask the Congress, their state committee or equivalent, is it okay for us to vote for independence? I've got copies of documents where South Carolina said, when you go to the convention, you will push for this, you will insist on this. If they don't do this, you will come home. They had written instructions that they carried up with them. And if they wanted to violate those instructions, they had to send back, and it took weeks to travel sometimes. They had to send back and get permission to go against their instructions. And they would not violate that trust that was given to them, unlike campaign promises today, which campaign promises are an evolution of the old instruction that went to the delegate who presented you.
Yeah, I remember they, fifth or sixth grade, they taught us that in history, and then slowly it disappeared. And I'm slowly remembering some of what I was taught. It's amazing. I thought I'd forgot about it.
Well, it's amazing what you can recall with just a little nudge in the right direction, huh? But you got to think about, you know, why were the committees written out of the history books? Why were the committees of safety written out of encyclopedias? Why were these organizations? I mean, if you look at Encyclopedia Britannica, the Rockefeller Foundation bought them up in the early 1900s. So guess what's written in there? And if you look in the Encyclopedia Britannica, you're not going to find much. I looked in the International Encyclopedia, and there's nothing. They've been written out of history, so we have to ask ourselves this. Why have the powers that be written this one specific group out of our history completely, almost?
They did it for a purpose. That was the primary foundation of the Continental Congress and of our freedom today. And that's why...
It was illegal, though, did they?
I'm sorry?
In reference to what somebody had asked earlier, they never said that committees of safety were illegal. They just made them disappear.
That's right. And slowly, and we let it happen, and that's what makes me so dadgum mad. But we only have ourselves to blame.
Well, if we don't heed what history taught us about committees of safety, we will have ourselves to blame. But since now that we've found, you know, I've got a half a dozen books. I've got the minutes of the Albany, New York Committee of Safety from before April 19th all the way until 1782. This information's out there if you go and find it. It's not in the textbook history, but it's there. And I'm putting documents up on the committee.org page. I've got more, but it's just a factor of time. But right now I probably have 100 documents I can put up there, and I've got a couple books that they're reduced. But when I read them, I'd have to transcribe them. They've got accounts of a lot of the things the committees did along the way of enforcing law, taking care of criminals, dealing with all kinds of situations, and the instructions to delegates. So the information is there, and we just need to understand and recognize that that is as much our birthright as the Constitution is.
In fact, the Committee of Safety was the formation of the Constitution.
It was.
The
Continental Congresses, which finally turned under the Articles of Confederation into the United States Congress, and then the committees were pretty much abandoned to the Continental Congress after July 1776 recommended to all the states that they rewrite their constitutions. Connecticut had already done so. But all the other colonies rewrote their constitutions. Rhode Island kept their charter for years. But at that point, a new government was instituted in the states. And that government was under a constitution or a charter. And it was the structure was based on the will of the people. So the need for the Committee of Safety diminished as each state then started adopting a constitution and a revised form of government consistent with what they felt should be, and that was then finalized by the time the federal constitution was adopted. But they were the transition. The reason we never went without government in this country in a transition from royal governor's ruling to the constitution, what kept the entire network of civil government in place during that entire period was committees of safety. Without them, we would have been like France, Russia, or any other African countries. You know, it would have been...
They were the very foundation of our freedom and what we know as freedom. Not today, but back then. And the militia is the enforcement arm of the Committee of Safety, and basically the militia doesn't have any rights until without a Committee of Safety. Am I correct?
Or the governor's recognition of them. You know, if the governor recognizes the committees or recognizes the militia, then the militia are duty-bound to submit to the will of the governor. But if the governor refuses, like they are in all 50 states, then there's only one other civil authority, really, and that's the committees.
That's right. And that the Committee of Safety gives legality to the militia to act without
right.
any repercussions.
According to a civil authority, it is a lawful militia.
Right. One other question, Gary. People in the various states that are interested in setting up, they can get all the info as to what they need required to do it by going through your website?
Yes, they can go to committee.org and look around there, and I think Randy has... Have you posted that, Randy?
I'll be posting it tonight on the blog and the forum.
Okay.
And on the website, and on the website itself.
So there will be a list of links that will take you to the various articles that I've put up about the committees of safety. And as I get time, I'll start putting more information up because, I keep learning more. The power of the committees of safety, I first found it back in 93, and every time I find a new book that's got information about committees of safety, I learn even more about their significance and the role they played in the creation of this country.
But something else also, I'm going to start holding either monthly or bi-monthly conference calls on Skype or some other way. Sorry about that, I didn't switch phones. I'm going to be holding a monthly or bi-monthly conference call on Skype or some other means. I'll be announcing when those are starting as well. Those will be basically a question and answer. For people that are wanting to start up a committee of safety, have already started a committee of safety, want to know what to do with their committee of safety, it's going to be question and answer. Randy.
Well, it's going to be more of a work session, really, because we'll be learning from you and you'll be learning from us. So
exactly.
It's a work session.
Exactly. We'll find out what's working in one area and see if we can implement that in another area. We'll find out what, it'll be an information sharing process. And, hopefully everybody will learn from it then, and people will start getting ideas on how to start really effectively using the committees. So I'll be starting those up here shortly. If you could get 3 to 5...
Committee, I have run across references to as little as 3 people forming a committee of safety.
Exactly. So if you could get 3 to 5 people together, email me or Gary, or go download the subscription form that he has. It's on his committee.org site. give Gary and myself an email or we'll give you a call or whatever it takes, and, you know, we'll get a committee started. Then we can start using that committee, you know, as a template for the other ones and start working on the other ones. Ohio, Equalizer with the Ohio Minuteman Militia, he's working on establishing the committees in all 88 counties there. He's already got militia in 74 counties, I believe. And every county he's in, he's going to make it mandatory that a committee of safety be established. You know, so we've got momentum. Pennsylvania is doing the exact same thing. Hell, we've got a gubernatorial candidate who's making a call to action for everybody in Pennsylvania to start forming committees.
Yeah, we gave him a little hard time, didn't we, Randy?
As far as starting committees of safety brings to mind a story that we told on an earlier show, and if you all weren't here at the time, it's worth noting. In 1400s, I guess it was.
Surely you're not going to say 1492, Gary.
1500s, it talks about it in one of the documents that you'll download or you'll read on the links. But Governor Andros was governor of New England, called New England at the time. And the militias were there. They had to be because of the Indians. Now, Andros was raising the quit rents, which was the tax on the rent on the land or the charter fees on the land. And he was abusive, and they didn't like him. They were subordinate to the governor, so they created a committee of safety. That committee of safety then directed them to arrest Governor Andros, which they did. Governor Andros was held in jail until the king recalled him to England. So can a militia transfer their allegiance from the governor to the committee of safety? Yes, they can even create the committee of safety in our history, this country. They can transfer that allegiance from the governor to the committee that they created, as long as it's a civil authority. And that's
and
what
will of the people.
These militias are doing.
Yeah, Minuteman down here in Texas, he's all for getting a committee of safety started, too. I believe Randy has talked to him several times about it, too.
Yes, actually, I've got a guy in Dallas, Texas. He was...
Ronnie.
No, Charles. No, I'm talking about there's a gentleman in Dallas, Texas. His name is Charles. He was on our show a week ago, I believe. He wrote a book. He was an author of a book. I forgot the name of the book now. I just finished it, too. Ah, man, I forgot the name of the book. It's in my past archives, though. But he's in Dallas, and he's wanting to form committees up, and he's also wanting to get in touch with some militia members up there. So I was going to have him get in touch with you and Ronnie and Rick and all those guys down there and see what you guys can do to help each other out, you know, as far as the militia and the committees go.
Yeah, and I'd like to say this is a community effort. I mean, not just because the one state wants to form one, the other states too. We all work together in this. Together we stand.
Yeah, what's important in back in the 90s, Dallas was kind of a key place because just down the road in Waco was where everything was happening. I've spoken to Dallas a few times when I was traveling. There are a lot of patriots in Dallas area now. A lot of them are older like me now. But what you need to do is get all the people in Dallas-Fort Worth area to get together and work together, and whether they want to create one in Dallas and one in Fort Worth or the Dallas-Fort Worth Committee of Safety, there's a lot of resource down there because of what happened in Waco. You know, the foundation's there. You've got some older people. Al Adask, I think he's still alive, would probably be interested in sitting on a Committee of Safety. The key is to get all the people interested in the Committee of Safety in Dallas-Fort Worth area together in one meeting and then work up that. Everybody's working together.
Yeah, I have a meet I'm going to up northeast Texas the 23rd, and I'm going to bring that up there, too, as part of the training.
Well, good for you, then. Like I said, you know, all we need, you know, all you really need to form a committee in any county you're in, or, you know, take your state and divide it up into four quadrants. You know, start that way. Get, you know, if you get three quadrants with committees in there, great, you start with that. But all you need to get it started is 3 to 5 people who are willing to say, I will make that subscription to be in the committees. That's it. Now you've got a committee, and we can start growing them from there.
I would say if you started with, say, 5 people in the committee and started operating as a committee and all of a sudden had an influx of people and had, say, at least 20 people in there, that it would be time to select a new chairman so that you have the will of the people as chairman. The first one in on a small group would be, you know, perhaps not the best choice. But at most a year sitting as chairman, maybe 6 months, so that you get diversity in the chair and you're open to all ideas and encourage participation by everybody. But if you start with 3 or 5 people, then start getting the word out to other people, invite them to the meeting. You might want to hold off selecting a chairman, just have a temporary chair until you bring in larger groups of people and have a better selection from which to choose the chairman, because the first chairman you get will have a lot to do with the success or failure of the Committee of Safety. In Orlando, it resulted in the failure, ultimate failure of the Committee of Safety, because the guy that felt that he was a dictator was the chairman of the Committee of Safety.
We even run into that problem here. Egos and personalities always step in. And I always try to tell people,
you don't guide by your personal
feelings. You have to do for the good of the people or the members. But it's a continuous problem.
I'm going to post the link to a thought on leadership. Okay, it's on the chat. And that's really is whether you succeed or fail is going to depend a lot, especially on the first chairman you have.
Yeah. That's so true. And that's why you have to proceed carefully. You want the best person for the job for the moment until a better one comes up.
That's always one good way to look at it. You're here until we find someone better.
Huh?
Well, that's why I say if you enlarge too much, if you, say, quadruple your size, maybe it's time to have another election for chairman because you've changed the whole nature of the group. If you go from 5 to 20 people, you've changed the whole nature. If you go from 20
that's right.
people, you've changed the nature. And significant changes like that probably warrant reconsideration. Now, if it was a good chairman you have, he'll get reelected. But if it's not, if you find somebody better and you want the best, especially at first, the first year or two until you get really rolling, you want the best chairman that you can possibly get to make sure that the unit, the committee works as a cohesive unit and is productive and gets things done. The whole thing is, the reason for the Committee of Safety is to get things done.
That's right, and you have to learn to roll with the flow as you grow. Because if you can't roll with it, you become stagnant. Maybe I used the wrong terminology there.
Well, I think I don't know if it becomes stagnant, but it can be destructive if you have somebody that wants to direct the committee on his in his direction rather than where the direction of the committee wants to go. This guy was chairman, and he managed to roll through that you had to be a U.S. citizen and have denounced your U.S. You had to be a state citizen and had to have denounced your U.S. citizenship to be a member of the committee. Now, the majority of the people at the meeting were U.S. citizens. So they would have outvoted him, except they got so pissed off at what he was trying to do that they said, screw you, and walked out.
Well, that was... They should have just held a straw vote right then and voted him out and put an interim in.
Well, they should have, and it's a shame that they didn't, but they were just so frustrated about the way where it was going. And he was the chairman, and the chairman does have influence. He wouldn't call on people. We've heard enough of that. He just people walked out. He kept going and going and going, and people just walked out. They left. So that's why it's so important that you read some thoughts on leadership and think that the guy that might appear to be the leader, that might be fine if he's going to grab a sword and you grab your rifles and you follow him into battle. You know, a true leader, during the Revolutionary War, there were true leaders. They were out on the battlefield. They weren't back in Florida directing drones. They were out in front of the troops saying, let's go. Now the only leaders we have are second lieutenants and first lieutenants, maybe occasionally a captain, but by the time you get to major and colonel and general, there's no leaders anymore. They're all sitting in some cush office deciding what you're going to do next to get yourself killed.
That's right, and don't rock the boat. All they're interested in is advancement.
Right.
I noticed that back in Vietnam.
And that's not what we're looking at today. What we're looking at today is getting back to the concept that the will of the people is very important. This is not top-down. If you're a leader, lead. If you're a chairman of a committee, find what the will of the committee is. Encourage everybody, the ones that dissent from it, work on getting them so that you've got a unanimous decision on something. We've talked about the petition, and one thing that we ran into running the petition last year was that 36 or 46, I don't remember how many items on the petition, but... would object to one of those and say, I'm not going to sign that petition because I don't like that. Well, that's kind of stupid. That's cutting off your nose to spite your face, because if you've got, you know, 97% of it you can support, and for 3% of it you say, I'm not going to sign your petition, how can we ever get our country back? Because we will never get total unanimity. Now, the Founding Fathers realized that, and many of their votes, so they were not unanimous. For example, the Declaration of Independence, so that it would be a unanimous declaration. 7 delegates left Philadelphia, so their vote would not count. They could not vote for it, but they did not want to undermine the presentation of the Declaration of Independence as being unanimous of all the colonies.
Yeah, so they abstained, right?
They didn't abstain. Oh, they left the delegation. If they were there, they
Okay.
And they actually left the conference. Actually, by the time the great signing of the declaration didn't occur until November. It was not signed on July 4th or 5th. The final wording was decided on, but then it had to be... written, published, and everything else, and it wasn't prepared for signatures until, I think it was November. And people came piecemeal. They drive by Philadelphia, stop, okay, I'll put my signature on. Things that they don't teach you in school, but you can find out if you look at real history books. But the importance of that unanimity, for example, like I said on the petition, if you don't like one part of it, but the rest of it is good and will help get this country back, why would you say, no, I won't sign it because I don't agree with that one thing? That's how we got where we are.
Yeah, that's right. Letting personalities and feelings and not the good of the country come into play.
And working together.
Yeah. Well, like old saying goes, together we stand, divided we fall. And divided we are, and we are falling if we don't stop it.
Well, you're right there, you know, and again, you know, I'd like to remind people, you know, this isn't basically, here's a response we've had so far. I posted a single blog on Ram's website about a week and a half ago, maybe 2 weeks ago. In 2 weeks, we've gotten a gubernatorial candidate who's making an open call to action for everybody in Pennsylvania to start forming them. We've got a Secretary of State in South Dakota who's calling for people to start forming them. Or a Secretary of State candidate in South Dakota who's calling for people to start forming these. We've got all of Ohio, all of Pennsylvania working on it, militias in Pennsylvania working on it as well. We've got you guys down in Texas. I've got those people, and those are statewide movements there. You know, other states, you know, I've got people saying, okay, you know, what do we need to do? So, you know, in less than 2 weeks' time, you know, you're looking at 15 states where people are already saying, we want in. How do we form them? Let's get it going.
Unless, yeah, maybe getting there with that guy in Pennsylvania, but at first we did give him a little hard time, made him commit himself exactly what he was talking about.
Well, he's going to be on the show tomorrow, so we'll be pinning him down tomorrow. What do you stand for?
Yeah, I just got so sick of politicians only saying what you want to hear and then doing as they want.
Well, when Randy
asked asinine about him.
And Randy said he was not, so I guess he might be a good guy. But if he's an attorney, he cannot be a good guy.
No. We have the attorneys to thank. But listen, we are down to our final 3 minutes. This 90 minutes has gone by quickly. So, Garrett, closing thoughts here?
I'm sorry?
I was like saying, Gary Layton, are there any closing thoughts here?
Well, for Kay, make sure you listen in next week, because next week we venture into the realm of possibility.
Okay, and I promise you I won't hog the phone next week.
Okay, everybody, this is a peaceful solution. Committees of safety are fundamental. If we want a peaceful solution, committees of safety are fundamental if there is not a peaceful solution. We're going to continue down the course we're on without committees of safety. It may sound severe, but look around you. Look what's happened for the last 20 years, 50 years, 150 years. Without committees of safety, without the people being heard again on what they want, what they believe, and what they think the restrictions on government should be, there will be no imposition of restriction on the government, and it will continue down the path towards, and I'm not sure where it's going, but it is not going in a good direction.
So
you got any closing announcements or anything?
That's about it. Listen, I'd like to remind everybody about a few forums that I belong to, people that have really supported the show and really helped out with it, and sites that I believe really give a ton of info. Shit Hit the Fan Militia, shtfmilitia.com, Well-Regulated American Militia, WellRegulatedAmericanMilitia.com, Modern Minuteman. Also, Gary's site, committee.org, again, vital. You know, it's going to be hard to teach 800 years of history that has been wiped out over the last year, you know, in a few shows. So, again, go to committee.org and begin reading. There's no videos on this stuff. You're not going to find it on YouTube, so you got to read. Put in a couple of hours a day of work into establishing committee, working on your militias, doing whatever it is, but begin putting in the work off the computer, off away from the TV, actual face-to-face street time. You know, this is not going to be a keyboard commando, you know, revolution. We're going to get our freedom back. If we're going to restore our government, it's going to take us getting out of the house and back into the streets and into our communities. So with that being said, I want to thank everybody for coming on, for listening in. If you have any questions, email myself or Gary, randymack@uftreadonme.com, hunt@outpost-of-freedom.com. Email us. We will get back to you. If you want help starting a committee up, just ask. We will walk you through it. We'd like to get other people that learn how to do this so they can start teaching others. So it's going to start somewhere. You know, we can't help get these started if we don't, if nobody asks us for that help. So it's going to start with you guys out there. We, Gary and I, can't make the guys. So keep that in mind, and everybody be safe, be free, educate your mind, and read the Constitution, and please try to understand it. You know, I think we read it too few times a year that we do. Most of us read the Constitution. So with that being said,
That might be a good point for a program sometime to go through the Constitution piece by piece.
That might be a damn good show, actually. So, with that being said, everybody take care. Have a wonderful night. Gary, thank you for coming on again, as always.
You're welcome.
And we will see you tomorrow. Don DeHaven will be on tomorrow. He's the gubernatorial candidate for Pennsylvania. And then we're also going to have Poker Face on. On Thursday, they are a truth rock band. I've actually spoken with these guys. Very strong into the second and a bunch of other stuff. So listen to them as well. That being said, we are done for the night. Take care, everybody, and be free. Bye-bye.